You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Think that a king in England could just by a few words give a great portion of Canada to only a handful of Englishmen. And of course, in this giveaway, they also included the Indians who lived in here, and the Indians had absolutely no say about it whatsoever.
Like, I was reading in the paper the other day how the government is having a really hard job trying to determine who to allow into the country. What with all the draft dodgers and all these people coming into the country, the government doesn't know what to do. And I can sympathize with the government, because unfortunately we didn't know either. Unfortunately, we let the wrong ones in.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lies, cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights rose me, in jails they all know me. frustrated our church man, saving a soul man, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they paw me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the life.
Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Please they arrest me, materialist to test me. Pollution it chokes me, movies they joke me. Politicians exploit me, city life jades me. Hudson, they fleece me, hunting laws throw me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
I think that your question contains an answer that many find difficult to accept. What I mean is that even those who define themselves as radical oftentimes see the racism which we are discussing as virtually accidental, as being not an organic extension of the culture and society and history upon which it was based. Many, even those who define themselves as radical, find it difficult to accept that when you had the so-called Glorious Revolution in England in 1688, which led to the clipping of the wings of the monarch, the rising merchant class did so, that is to say, clip the wings of the monarch, in order to gain a foothold in the lucrative African slave trade, which theretofore had been controlled by the monarch. Then in 1776, you had landowners and slave owners like George Washington, who clipped the wings of the monarch once again by revolting against the idea that England was moving towards the abolition of slavery, a la Somerset's case in June 1772 in London, and thereby move towards secession and independence, creating a society based upon white supremacy and slavery. Then in 1836, you see slave owners in Texas revolt and secede from Mexico, not least because Mexico had moved towards the abolition of slavery in the preceding decade, the 1820s, under a leader of African descent, speaking of Vicente Guerrero. And of course, because Texas independently could not withstand the pressure placed upon it by abolitionist Britain and revolutionary Haiti, Texas then entered the Union as a state of the United States of America in 1845. And finally, in 1865, the so-called Confederate States of America seceded from the United States once again because they wanted to perpetuate slavery forevermore. But because of global pressure in the first place, they were defeated. It's very difficult even for radicals to come to the conclusion that this society and culture that was built here in North America was based not only on the enslavement on a mass basis of Africans, but on a genocidal dispossession of the indigenous population. And therefore, it's no surprise that racism in its most brutal and naked form continues to stalk the land in 2018.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And this is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Karl Marx. It's a very important day for us. And that was, of course, Gerald Horn speaking about the on the occasion of the 200th anniversary of the birth of Karl Marx on the Real News Network just today. And he, of course, was talking about the history, the historical context of colonialism and racism in North America, and really tying it to the kind of struggles we see in North America today. And it's, of course, the history that many people do not know, or they do not understand. What we're going to do today on the show is something which is long overdue, I think. It's something I've never done before on the show, or at least not done adequately. And that is something I definitely criticize myself about, and I think rightly so, is I have not, on the show, really gone into the colonial history of Canada and the struggles of Indigenous people. Obviously, I've talked about them with regard to various struggles they were involved in, whether that's like most recently the Kinder Morgan pipeline, stopping the expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline. But in terms of getting into the actual history, you know, looking at the themes that we see in Canadian history and, you know, just how all these things fit together, all these different struggles, the entire history going back, you know, 300 years. Of the things that went on here, the history that took place, what made this country what it is, you know, the very racist colonial history that made this country what it is, that is something I haven't really gone into in a really systemic way. And I think that is, but that's going to change today. That is going to change today. So I have with me here Brendan Campisi.
Hi.
And I'm going to have to turn his mic on because I neglected to do that. See?
Hello, everyone.
We get it? There we go. And, of course, you know Brendan Campisi. He's been on the show before. We've talked about numerous things. I think the last thing we talked about was about the war in Vietnam last year, setting the record straight on just how horrific and brutal that imperialist war was, waged by the American Empire and the Vietnamese people. But today, we're going to unpack the colonial history in Canada and the struggles of Indigenous people for liberation, national liberation, going you know, back in the 19th century all the way to today. That's what we're going to unpack today. And so I think we said we were going to start by talking a little bit about, well, the man like who was actually speaking at the beginning of the show. I played a clip of him, Howard Adams. But we also do want to talk about the documentary that is from, that clip of him speaking. It's from a documentary called The Other Side of the Ledger, which came out with the National Film Board of Canada in 1972. Particularly dealing with the history of the Hudson's Bay Company and their relations with Indigenous people going up to 1972. So maybe we can start with that.
Sure.
Because that's, I think, a good place to start when you talk about colonial history in Canada.
Yeah. So as you just mentioned, The Other Side of the Ledger was a documentary that was produced by the National Film Board that came out in 1972. And the occasion for that documentary being created was 1970, of course, was the 300th anniversary of the chartering of the HBC. And I was, you know, surprised to learn this. I didn't know it until I watched the documentary, that this was something that was celebrated with a great deal of pageantry by the HBC and by the Canadian state. And it was made into this sort of romantic occasion. And obviously, you know, 1970 is a moment of a lot of, you know, indigenous you know, political activity. Lots of people are mobilizing, becoming conscious of colonialism. So there was a lot of objection, obviously, to Indigenous people who were the victims of the exploitation of the HBC to the fact that it was being celebrated. So some people working for the NFB, including, you know, Indigenous filmmakers working for the NFB, decided to create this documentary that would present sort of the other, you know, the other side of the history of the Hudson's Bay Company and also of what was then still a very current reality, because the documentary also sort of goes to these, the filmmakers went to these communities in northern Saskatchewan, northern Manitoba, where the HBC was still at that time ruthlessly exploiting Indigenous people. So the clips that we heard from that, so there was a voice at the beginning, the voice of Howard Adams talking about the charter of the HBC. And Howard Adams was from a Métis community called Saint-Louis in Saskatchewan. And he was born in the 1920s. And he left his community. He tried to assimilate into white society. Eventually, he went to the United States, and he got a PhD from Berkeley in the 1960s. And he was impacted by the student movement. He was impacted by the struggle of black people in the United States. he was especially influenced by people like Malcolm X. And so he sort of became radicalized and decided to return to Canada and to participate in the struggle of Indigenous people that was developing in Canada by the late 1960s. And he became one of the leading figures of the Red Power movement in Canada. And he was, you know, he was a Marxist, and he wrote a really brilliant and at the time very, very influential sort of Indigenous Marxist sort of work of revisionist history on mostly Western Canada called Prison of Grass that came out in 1975. And then after Howard Adams, we heard Ontario-born Anishinaabe comedian and writer Duke Redbird. And then there was also that was also from the same documentary. And then there was a song by Willie Dunn, who's a Mi'kmaq singer-songwriter, who was also very active in the movement at this time, and also worked for the National Film Board. The National Film Board in the late 1960s had a group called the Indian Film Group of sort of young Indigenous filmmakers who, for the very first time, started making, you know, these documentary films dealing with Indigenous experience. So yeah, I think it's a remarkable sort of historical document and in some ways a historical resource. So yeah, we just wanted to point that out. I will say one very quick thing relating to the anniversary, the 200th anniversary of Karl Marx. But to sort of tie it back into Canada. So, of course, Karl Marx never went to Canada, but Frederick Engels did. In 1888, Frederick Engels was traveling in eastern North America. I think he sort of went in a circle beginning and ending in New York City. And I think he crossed the border at Niagara and went through, you know, to Toronto and then Kingston and then Montreal. And he said that Canada was... what he found in Canada was, he said something like, more abandoned farmhouses than anywhere except Ireland, and he thought that the country was just going to fail economically and be absorbed by the United States. That was Engels' prediction for the future of Canada in the 1880s. And then, as far as I know, you know, important figures in the history of, you know, the international communist movement have only ever been in Canada, you know, twice after that. One, Trotsky was interned by the British military in Halifax on the way back to Russia after the February Revolution. And he tried to, you know, agitate the German prisoners of war, and he made all kinds of trouble for the authorities, and eventually they let him go. And then Fidel Castro came here in 2000 for Pierre Trudeau's funeral, because they were personally close. And we'll get into some of Pierre Trudeau's crimes later in the show, but that's, you know, that's sort of a curious historical moment. So every so often, you know, every few decades, something like that has happened here in Canada. But yeah.
Yeah. But of course, one of the things I myself have mentioned, I, Siegfried, on the show, like I've mentioned quite a number of times, is the role that Marxism played in fighting against colonialism around the world and inspiring anti-colonial struggles around the world in the 20th century. And this is how Marxism in many ways moved beyond the confines of, say, Europe, mm-hmm. for the most part, you know, the European-centered kind of world, being Euro-centered philosophy, you know, mode of action, this kind of thing, ideology, to becoming a global phenomenon. It really was in the context of decolonization that really took place. And, of course, the Russian Revolution took place in, you could say, in something of that context.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of decolonization. So... But in terms of when we look at Canada, when we look at the struggles of Indigenous people, and when we look at the struggles of settlers against oppressive authority, we're dealing with different things.
Yes.
You know, and we look at the 19th century, I think that becomes quite clear. I mean, we look at the, say, the Upper Canada Rebellion or the Lower Canada Rebellion, where settlers actually did revolt against the British colonial authorities, against the British Empire, in British North America, and you compare that, of course, with Indigenous resistance and rebellion and struggles like such as that of Louis Riel in the Northwest. These are happening in very different contexts. I mean, even though, as we will mention, there was some intersection,
yeah,
between these two things, and so, and as we know in Canadian history, there's a capacity for selective memory of these different things. And, you know, at certain times, like, you know, there has been massive focus upon Upper and Lower Canada rebellions to the, you know, and not enough emphasis on Indigenous struggles. And then, of course, like, you know, there's just this this discontinuity between those things. And of course, like, this is the ultimately, we have talked about, like, Canada being a very conservative place. Ultimately, this is an area where the British Empire in many ways triumphed over all the attempts to overthrow it or create some sort of new political order in this country, in this, you know, geographical space, I should say, in in this, on this continent. So this is something I think we maybe we could get into, because I know you've done quite a bit of research into the 19th century, into the different movements against anti-colonial movements in the 19th century, and the various limitations and the various dynamics of that. So maybe we could kind of unpack some of that history.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess. Yeah, I'll start saying a little bit about 1837, 1838. It's interesting you talk about sort of the degree to which people have often focused on that in the past. And I think it's very, very interesting to look at sort of different points in the history of the Canadian left and the way that the Canadian left has dealt with Canadian history. Because both in the 1930s and 40s, with sort of the left centered around the Communist Party, and then in the 1960s and 70s with the sort of the new left in Canada, there was a very concerted attempt to use that history of the Upper Canada rebellions. And I think I referred to this in conversation. It's been said that in France, sort of liberalism and people's sort of understanding of where their rights and freedoms come from as, you know, citizens of the Republican national community is a historical thing that's seen to be derived from the revolution in 1789. And the same thing in the United States is derived from 1776. And the communists in Canada in the 1930s attempted to convince Canadians that they should see their, you know, their rights and freedoms that they had and, you know, what they should be fighting for, you know, to gain that they didn't, were in some ways inherited from or derived from the heritage of 1837 and 1838. And this is why, for example, the Canadian contingent in the International Brigades was called the Mackenzie-Papineau Battalion, because it was named after the leader, you know, the English-Canadian leader of the Upper Canada Rebellion, William Lyon Mackenzie, and the leader of the Lower Canada Rebellion, Louis-Joseph Papineau. And so there was an attempt to sort of to use that history. And then again, in the 1960s and 70s, the new left in Canada, especially in English-speaking Canada, was profoundly nationalist. And there was this idea that Canada was, you know, Canada was a marginal sort of place within the American Empire, and that Canadians needed to struggle for Canadian independence. And that was a significant part of the, you know, the task of the left in Canada. And so there was a lot of research into the Upper Canada Rebellions, and there was a lot of sort of culture. There was, or the Upper Canada Rebellion, I'll get to the Lower Canada Rebellion in its own sort of history and memory in a second. For example, Rick Salutin writes The Farmer's Revolt, which is sort of a play. It's comedic, but it is supposed to have this serious sort of popular nationalist message. And to sort of convey this idea of, you know, of the working masses can have sort of their own version of Canadian national identity. And that's what the communists in the 1930s were trying to create, and that's what the new left in the 1970s were trying to create, was sort of a popular democratic version of Canadian nationalism, which up to that point didn't exist, substantially because 1837, 1838 had been defeated. Get to that in a second. In Lower Canada, in Quebec, there's a much stronger popular memory of the Lower Canada Rebellion, partly because it was, in fact, a larger scale event. It had more popular support when it took place, and also because there was a continuing nationalist movement in Quebec through the 19th century. Although for most of the 19th century and the early 20th century, nationalism in Quebec predominantly took a very conservative, you know, clerical form. But there was still a popular memory of 1837, 1838, and the radical nationalist movement in Quebec in the late 60s and early 70s, which we'll talk more about later, made a lot of use of the memory of Les Patriotes and the, you know, the uprising in 1837, 1838. For a time, the left in Quebec didn't use what we think of as the Quebec flag. They used the flag of the Patriotes, which I think is sort of, you know, it's a symbolic gesture akin to the fact that the left in Spain today doesn't use the flag of the Kingdom of Spain. They use the flag of the Second Republic. And so it's interesting that they had an alternative national symbolism That is, you know, at this point, also the Quebec bourgeoisie is formulating its own sort of version of a nationalist project in the 1960s and 70s. And so the people who were trying to create a popular, a democratic, in this case specifically a socialist version of that nationalist project sort of had their own set of symbols to refer to. So that's really interesting. But yeah, as for the, you know, sort of the actual historical substance of the rebellions themselves, I think it's important to see them as having a sort of a threefold significance, which is the most important one is that they were democratic struggles, right? Upper and Lower Canada in the 1830s did not have, you know, even by the standards of the time, you know, any kind of functioning liberal democratic structures. They were basically run by tiny oligarchies, and there were no elected assemblies. They were totally unaccountable. And that was the main sort of grievance. That was the main political framework of the rebellions was republican liberalism and the idea of popular sovereignty, which was still at that time a revolutionary idea. In most of Europe, popular sovereignty had not been achieved. Obviously, popular sovereignty in the United States was tainted by white supremacy, but it was seen as being, you know, superior to the system that existed in British North America by the Canadian rebels. And they actually received some support not from the United States government, which had, by that point had made its peace with the British Empire, but by some, you know, ordinary Americans who believed in republicanism and who believed that Canada should be a republic. So there's the democratic significance. And this is where I think it's very important that they were defeated. There's also a class significance in that, you know, it wasn't just political power that was very, very monopolized in the colonial, you know, society in Upper and Lower Canada at that time. It was also economic power. There were, you know, there was a very, very small capitalist class, and political and economic power were seen, especially sort of within the framework of early 19th century republicanism, to be very tightly interlinked. And of course, Republicans were trying to establish a liberal capitalist order. And what they didn't want was for, you know, for people with connections through their families, through their friendships with influential people, to be able to game the system of capitalism and gain access to more land, you know, government contracts, that those things should be free and fair and open, right? And again, you know, this is a historical period where that struggle for open capitalism can still be seen as, you know, as a historically progressive one. So there's the class, but the class significance isn't just that. It's also that there was a participation by, you know, the rank and file of the movements. Many of them were, you know, they were farmers, they were artisans. The leadership were mostly, you know, petty bourgeois people, professionals. Papineau was, in fact, a seigneur. He was a wealthy landowner, but he happened to have progressive republican ideas, whereas Mackenzie was a newspaper man. So, he, you know, in the middle rank, you know, the middle to lower rank of the colonial society. But many of the rank and file were, you know, artisans and farmers, as were many of their supporters in the United States. And in fact, some of their supporters in the United States were connected to the labor movement that was actually starting to form, which didn't exist, you know, in Canada yet, because industrialization hadn't reached, you know, Canada in 1837. But in the northern states, it was starting to form, and there was starting to be, you know, a distinct political consciousness, a sort of a working class republicanism. No socialist politics, and not even really labor politics as it would exist within a couple of decades. But the labor Republicans in the United States sympathized with the Canadian Rebellion, and they didn't care that their government had made its peace with the British monarchy, because they still considered it to be, you know, an affront to the rights of man. And then specifically in Lower Canada, alongside the democratic and class significance of the rebellion, there was also a national significance. Because, of course, since 1763, the French-Canadian people had been, you know, subject to national oppression. And there was a very, very small co-opted French-Canadian elite, but which, again, Papineau was part of, but he just sort of chose to break away from. But for the vast majority of French-Canadian people, you know, they were excluded from political power. They were excluded from social advancement. They were, excluded from a lot of things. And there was a desire to have an independent state for the French Canadian people, and that's why the factor of national oppression is probably why the rebellion in Lower Canada was so much larger. There were probably something like 25,000 people who participated in some form, and several thousand people who participated very actively in the rebellion in Lower Canada. In Upper Canada, it's a bit chaotic. You know, there were only a few hundred people who participated, and militarily, it was it was really nothing for the British to deal with the Upper Canada Rebellion. It was sort of more of a political problem. They'd gotten to that point. The rebellion in Lower Canada took months to repress. Hundreds, maybe 100 people were killed in battle. 29 were executed in the aftermath of that. And something like 60 were sent to Australia. And in both colonies, some undocumented number of people fled to the United States rather than be punished by the British. And there were sort of these, I mentioned these American supporters, they continued engaging in sort of raids along the Canadian border into 1839. So there was really sort of a two-year period of this, you know, this Republican challenge to British authority. And so something that Canadian Marxist historian Ian MacKay talks about in a few pieces, but especially in this, what I think is a great essay called The Canadian Passive Revolution, is that sort of Canadian political culture is seen as being defined by compromise and by a kind of conservatism in which any change that you're going to try to advocate has to be made extremely gradually, and it absolutely has to be made within the framework of the existing institutions. You can't upset, you know, you can't upset the horses. And that's seen as not simply being, you know, pragmatic and useful. It's that being pragmatic is seen, you know, by the Canadian elite as being an essential part of Canadian identity. And that's been sort of propagated through Canadian culture and through the way that Canadian history is, you know, is normally taught, that that is just the way that we do things. And I think to a large extent that profound conservatism, it's so exemplified by the fact that, you know, what's supposed to be our sort of cultural motto is peace, order, and good government, rather than, you know, liberté, égalité, fraternité, or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or whatnot. You know, in these other, you know, in the states that are the product of successful Atlantic revolutions, because we had a defeated Atlantic revolution, we end up with peace, order, and good government, which is, you know, it's intrinsically conservative. And so there's a conservatism that anyone who wants to operate within the mainstream of Canadian political culture, as we've inherited it, has to take on. And I think that's to a large extent a reflection of the defeat of the Republican alternative in 1837. Now, of course, as I said, many of these rebels were deeply sympathetic to the United States. And if you want to engage in historical counterfactuals for a second, if those rebellions had succeeded and there, you know, a republic in Upper and Lower Canada, there's a decent chance that they would have just joined the United States rather than, you know, created some sort of, you know, some sort of Canadian republic, you know, one or two, as the case may have been. But the fact is, you know, that didn't happen. There was no Canadian republic and, you know, British North America didn't become part of the United States. And what we ended up with was Canada, you know, Canada as we see it today. And so I do think it's important to, to sort of take note of that turning point and to recognize that, you know, the fact that there was a self-consciously defined revolutionary uprising against British political authority within the colonial society itself in the early 19th century, and that this had to be put down, especially in Lower Canada, with significant force, basically proves the retroactive myth of peace, order, and good government wrong. That there's not something, you know, intrinsically impossible about revolutionary struggle happening in this society. It's just that there was a relatively early example that was successfully defeated, and that sort of, you know, it made the idea seem impossible to people who supported it and created a situation where the ruling elite that had successfully put the rebellions down could portray it as simply nature, basically. That this just, you know, it can't happen here.
Okay. So, I mean, that's a lot to take in, right? I mean, this entire history here. I mean, that's certainly like way more than I learned in grade 8 history class when we actually talked about like the Upper and Lower Canada Rebellion. But of course, one of the things that needs to be pointed out about the Upper and Lower Canada Rebellions and the people who participated in them is that they were indeed settlers.
Yes.
You know, these people were living on stolen native land when they're, even if they were fighting for, you know, independence against a colonial empire, they remained settlers. on those stolen native land. So, and the role that stolen indigenous land plays in the creation of Canada, of course, is crucial. And of course, you can engage in counterfactuals, like what would that mean for like a Canadian Republic? But I mean, that would be like the Canadian Republic would be predicated on that as well.
Yes.
Like if something had succeeded in Upper Canada or Lower Canada, this sort of thing, that would have remained a constant. And we, of course, would see political struggles around that now with regard to Indigenous people fighting for their liberation, for national liberation. But regard to that role, that especially cheap land taken from Indigenous people, like especially in places like Upper Canada and the areas around, like, say, Toronto, you know, these kind of areas, but really all over the country. Like, maybe we can talk a little about, like, how that played just a crucial fundamental role in shaping the colonial state that really Canada is.
Yeah, so I think this has to be sort of seen as, you know, basically this, you know, the center of Canadian history, and especially the center of the history of, and the development of capitalism in Canada. And this is something, so a Dene scholar, Glenn Coulthard, a few years ago came out with a book called Redskins, White Masks, and one of the sort of the basic, which is, you know, and puts forward, you know, a number of different sort of arguments about Indigenous politics in Canada. But one thing that he sort of, that he argues is that the best way to understand the process of colonialism in Canada is through the Marxist concept of primitive accumulation, through the sort of the need of capitalism, especially in its early stages, but actually continuing down to this day, the need of capitalism to take land and resources that are outside of the sphere of capitalist markets and to bring them into it. And substantially, you know, in North America, what that has meant is turning Indigenous land into settler property. That's, you know, that's the process of primitive accumulation in Canada. The examples that Marx uses to talk about that are mostly, you know, the appropriation of the commons in within Europe. But he does, even in, you know, even in Capital, Marx talks about the enslavement of the Indigenous population of the Americas and the enslavement of people in Africa as being part of the birth of capitalism in this way, as being part of, and as well as in the European colonies in Asia, as being part of primitive accumulation. And so one thing that sort of cleared up this a lot for me, especially when it comes to our local history here in Southern Ontario, which I think is important because mostly when people talk about the history of, you know, colonial, you know, dispossession and displacement in Canada, we often default to talking about examples from the West, especially the late 19th century West. We talk about the treaty, the early numbered treaties. We talk about Louis Riel, we talk about 1885, and we're going to do that later in the show. But, you know, every single inch of this country at some point has been appropriated from the Indigenous people. You know, in the St. Lawrence Valley, it was just done by force, right? Through a series of wars between the French and the Haudenosaunee. And in Nova Scotia, it was also done by naked force. There was a series of wars between the British and the Mi'kmaq. You know, in Newfoundland, it was carried out through outright genocide. And the, you know, the Indigenous nation who exclusively lived on that island, obviously there are a number of Indigenous peoples who live partly in Newfoundland and partly outside of it, but the one Indigenous nation that lived exclusively on Newfoundland, the Beothuk, were absolutely exterminated. So you can see the sort of naked violence. But here in Southern Ontario, this is not seen as having been a violent process in the way that it might have been in other, sort of more obviously in other places in Canada or in the United States. But if we have to, you know, if we're able to expand our view of what violence is and to think about structural violence, I think it's very clear that, you know, the process of turning, you know, turning this land into Upper Canada in the first place and then, you know, Ontario was a violent one. So what's now Southern Ontario in the 17th century was fairly, very densely inhabited by settled agricultural people, the Attawandaron, the Neutral, the Wendat, and the Haudenosaunee sort of around the southern areas of it. And there was, you know, a series, as everyone does learn in their Canadian history classes as a kid, there's a series of conflicts between these different nations, the Haudenosaunee ally with the English and the Wendat ally with the French. Eventually, the Haudenosaunee are victorious, and they drive a lot of people out. Recently, many people are starting to argue that this is sort of exaggerated, and the degree to which the Haudenosaunee were, you know, a conquering, you know, violent force has been greatly exaggerated, and that many, many people who had been living here, the nations that had been living here, were absorbed by intermarriage, which was very, very common in, you know, in Indigenous North America. But by the late 18th century, the French, you know, the French never settled here in Southern Ontario in any significant number. There were small posts. Obviously, there was a post at Detroit, and there was actually a fort at Toronto at certain points. But generally speaking, Southern Ontario in the late 18th century, when it was transferred from Britain or from France to Britain, was inhabited by relatively small numbers of Anishinaabe and Mississauga people, or Ojibwe and Mississauga people, who are subgroups of sort of the broader Anishinaabe kind of family. And there was, you know, probably several thousand people. It was sparsely inhabited, but it was inhabited. And there were sort of semi-permanent settlements in many places. And then sort of groups that had, you know, Europeans always perceived indigenous people who didn't farm as being just sort of nomads who wandered the earth randomly. But that's not how anybody lives. And, you know, indigenous nations all over North America had, or, well, you know, specific subgroups of people, right, had life practices that involved specific sort of seasonal rounds, right? There was nothing random. There was nothing chaotic about it. In any case, in the 1780s, the British start to take the land here in Southern Ontario. And so basically up until that point, treaties between the British and, well, also the French, but focusing on the British here, and indigenous nations had been genuine treaties. Normally they've been to form military alliances. To a lesser extent, they've been to establish trading relations. So that's what the people here living here in Southern Ontario thought was happening when the British started signing treaties with them in the 1780s and the 1790s. Actually, the British were trying to appropriate the land. And so they would, you know, these treaties would be signed that the British considered to have given them ownership over, you know, these vast, vast areas of land. In some cases, they were actually fraudulent even by British law. The original purchase of Toronto in the early 1790s was deemed in a British court to have been illegal. But in any case, you know, a series of treaties are signed that cover most of Southern Ontario in the 1780s, 1790s. After 1800, in the 1790s, English-speaking settlers, mostly coming from the United States, escaping the American Revolution, start to settle in what is now Southern Ontario. And the economics of that process and how it plays into the development of capitalism in Canada are described very, very ably in a PhD dissertation. It was written by Simon Victoria Freeman called Toronto Has No History, which is sort of examining Toronto and Southern Ontario more generally as a place where, as a site of colonialism, and what the significance of that is. And so the way that she describes it is that Upper Canada, created as a colony in 1791, basically initially had no economy. There was no budget for anything administrative. There was a few military posts here and there. There was no farming going on, and there was no trade. So the only way to create revenue and to create sort of a base of capital was these treaty purchases where land was appropriated from the indigenous people for virtually nothing by the crown and then sold by the crown to these speculative companies that were being formed in Britain at a level that was profitable for the crown in that, you know, they accumulated some sort of revenue from that, but cheap enough that the speculative companies could then sell it extremely cheaply to ordinary settlers coming in from the United States or moving from Britain, and the settlers could get land very, very cheaply, and the speculators could make a huge profit. And it's the people who profit from this appropriation and the land speculators who essentially go on to form the wealthy oligarchy that the rebels are trying to overthrow in 1837. The rebels coming out of the settler society that's created at this time through this sort of process of class formation that creates both sort of the strata of the ordinary farming people and the capitalist class. So essentially, by appropriating land for virtually nothing, they were able to turn indigenous land into capital without so much as putting a stake into it, without doing anything. This is before agriculture has, before British people have started farming on this land, and somebody has already made a profit off of it. And by the 1790s, you have people starting to come in, setting up their farms, and the Mississauga and Ojibwe people living in Southern Ontario begin to, you know, to recognize that they're being crowded out, and their lakes are being overfished, and the settlers are cutting down the forests, and they're overhunting the game. And many of them start to consider resisting, because immediately to the south of Erie and Ontario in the Ohio country, a confederation of indigenous nations were resisting the United States very successfully in the 1790s. And so there were plans for armed resistance here in Southern Ontario in the 1790s. And the only reason that that didn't happen was that Joseph Brant and the Six Nations people refused to join. Joseph Brant has gone down in Canadian history as, Daniel Francis in The Imaginary Indian, you know, sort of talks about these sort of this handful of Indian heroes, of good Indians, in the Canadian historical consciousness because he was loyal to the British crown, because he saw it as being in the interests of his people. But as Freeman discusses, by the end of his life, Joseph Brant was discredited. He was seen as having, well, he was discredited among his own people because he was seen as having given far too much away to the British. In any case, so this continues. And one thing that happened specifically with the Toronto Purchase that's just absolutely disgusting is that so by the late 1790s, the Crown in Upper Canada and the people who are building, you know, York at that point, what it's called, know that they have broken the law. They've broken their own laws. So essentially, and they're receiving complaints from the Mississauga about this. So basically, they wait for this process of settlement in the territory and of the, the appropriation of the land itself, the setting up of settler farms, the clearing the forests, etc., to impoverish the Mississauga so much that they're willing to renegotiate the purchase of Toronto for basically nothing. And so in 1805, Toronto is purchased, you know, to all appearances, legally, legitimately, you know, by British standards. They can be satisfied and have a clean conscience about it. But in effect, the Mississauga people sold Toronto in a sign or starve situation that we would recognize from, you know, and this is one of the things that, again, does make it into the history textbooks, the sign or starve situations that Indigenous nations on the prairies would be facing in the 1870s. I think sort of the really salient points there are to recognize that, you know, even if there's only sort of a few points where we can see very direct violence, you know, some point or another, everywhere, everywhere in this country has been, you know, taken and appropriated, and we have to see that as a violent process in itself. And further, that, you know, there's two results of that violent process. The one result is, you know, Indigenous people living in poverty in small marginal, you know, in small areas of marginal land. You know, the most of the people here in Southern Ontario, they either live in a small, you know, ended up by 1830, 1840, living in a small number of reserves or off on Manitoulin, which at that time, the British government said would be like Oklahoma, like the Indian country in the U.S., would be a preserve for the native people for all time. Obviously, by the 1860s, they reneged on their promise with regard to Manitoulin. And then the other result is, you know, the settler society comes into being where the British government can, or the Upper Canadian government can lay out the infrastructure, the roads, the canals, so that once the settler farmers do have a crop, they're able to get it out to the market very quickly. And, you know, by the mid-19th century, Upper Canada is one of the wealthiest places in the British Empire, and it's very much a site seen as a site of opportunity for young people facing hard times in industrializing Britain to come to. And then on the other hand, the other result within the settler society itself is that you have essentially the birth of the bourgeoisie in Canada from the process of, appropriating land and then speculating on it. And again, you know, they were able to basically just turn Indigenous land into capital through this process. And that is, that's the foundation of Canadian wealth, along with the fur trade, which I think we'll also get into.
Yeah, because of course, like the fur trade, and this of course leads us into Western Canada and the role that this particularly played in the provinces of Manitoba, like in Saskatchewan, in Alberta, and these points with regard to like the relationship that organizations like the Hudson's Bay Company had with the with Indigenous people, and how that changed when settlement started to push west, and actually you had large numbers of actual people of European descent actually emerging into these places in Western Canada and completely changing the nature of society, relationship with the land, this sort of thing. And of course we saw that with the Red River Rebellion.
Yeah.
You know, and the resistance of the Métis people against that process in Manitoba. And of course you saw that in the Northwest Rebellion with Louis Riel once again leading the Métis people in a struggle for their own self-determination, which, of course, is very well known, but some of the aspects of that struggle are really not well known. So maybe we could really kind of get into some of that, because, of course, this this has a strong relationship with what we've been talking about.
Sure. Yeah. So just to a couple summary things about the fur trade in general. I think it's, you know, it is generally known that the fur trade played a crucial role in the foundation of the Canadian economy. And I don't think that that in itself would be considered a controversial statement to the same degree that, you know, for example, if you start pointing out that plantation agriculture, slave plantation agriculture in the southern United States, is the foundation of the prosperity of U.S. capitalism, even though, you know, economic historians are increasingly documenting that fact. Everyone knows that the fur trade is where Canada's wealth comes from in the first place. What I don't think people know, I don't think, you know, Canadians generally know, is the kind of violence and exploitation that actually went into that process of the fur trade. Because it was a deeply violent and deeply exploitative process. The Hudson Bay Company especially always tried to pay as little as possible to the indigenous people that it was paying for furs. And a fundamental point is that I think we have to see you know, the indigenous people who were providing furs for the fur trading companies as performing labor, right? And that, you know, the process of turning a beaver or a muskrat in the woods into a saleable commodity is labor. And they were creating value by doing that, that the HBC and the Northwest Company and the other fur trading companies that came in later were appropriating. And the fur trade was immensely profitable. The fur trade was the thing that, you know, young men in the glens of Scotland in the 18th and 19th centuries dreamed about making their fortunes in. Especially the Northwest Company was run by a clique of Highland Scottish families. Everybody was either a McGilvery or a McTavish or a Bethune, basically. And yes, those Bethunes. That's where Norman Bethune's family's wealth came from. It was from the fur trade. So it was a hugely, hugely wealthy thing, wealthy, you know, industry. I think the HBC in its first couple hundred years made something like £20 million of profits. And the Northwest Company at certain points was making £300,000 every year. And they're making this off of the labor of indigenous people. And they're doing it by paying extortionately low prices. The HBC in certain situations was so committed to paying rock bottom prices for its furs that they were willing to allow people to starve to death outside of their posts. There's a very notable case of that sort of in the later period of the trade in what's now Labrador. In the 1830s and 1840s, there was a famine, and the HBC let the people, the Innu people living there, starve because they wouldn't sell their furs cheaply enough. There was also violence between the companies, and the Northwest Company and the HBC, especially between the 1790s and 1821, and they manipulated indigenous people into killing each other as, you know, allies of these companies. And there were cases all over the West of fur traders, you know, threatening and physically intimidating and murdering indigenous people who were not willing to cooperate with them, not willing to work for them, not willing to sell their furs. And the HBC saw the native people as being its workforce. You know, Howard Adams says the HBC's charter gave it the native people. And that's the truth. The HBC's charter gives it sovereignty over that territory in 1670. It gives it the authority to raise an army, to build forts, and to make war against people who are not Christians. And obviously, no indigenous people in North America, well, not in North America, some of the Wendat down south here were, but no indigenous people in Rupert's Land in 1670 were Christians. So it gave them the authority to engage in war against the people if it was deemed to be necessary. And they did exercise violent authority over people at times. Also, there were, you know, really harmful effects of the fur trade on the long-term sort of economic health of the indigenous communities and of the ecological health of the continent, in fact. Obviously, the North American beaver was almost exterminated by the fur trade. At one point in what's now, I think, Montana, Idaho, the HBC was competing with some American companies, and they decided to prevent these American companies from expanding into this one area by creating a fur desert. That's what they called it. They were just going to trap out all the fur-bearing areas in this entire mountain range and prevent the Americans from coming into it, because they were a capitalist enterprise. There's some historical work in the HBC that refers to it as sort of feudal, but at least by the early 19th century, they're operating on, you know, liberal market capitalism. Well, except the fact that they had a monopoly, but they were behaving on the international markets versus their competitors as, you know, a capitalist enterprise, and they were very, very ruthless about it. And so they did things like that, which obviously are ecologically destructive, but also destructive of, you know, the game and the land base of the indigenous people. And in the long term, as the indigenous people became progressively more and more absorbed in the fur trade, and what had begun as sort of something that was subsidiary to their own sort of kin, communal, subsistence economy became the main way that they made a living, because the HBC sort of, especially, tried to nurture dependence on them. They progressively started to, you know, to overhunt and overtrap these fur-bearing animals that they also depended on for a wide variety of other things, including food, and were progressively undermining their own economic self-sufficiency. And the trading companies also introduced alcohol into Western North America, specifically, and this is something that you can find people admitting in their diaries, right, as a tool for, you know, for manipulating people and making them part with their wealth, with their immense sort of, you know, natural wealth, more easily. And as, you know, as Adams points out in Prison of Grass, the fur trade also sowed the seeds of racism in Canadian society, because just as, you know, in the plantation economy in the Caribbean and in the slave trade on the west coast of Africa, the slave traders and the plantation owners had these opinions and these stereotypes about the suitability of different African nationalities for different kinds of work. The records of the HBC are filled with these kinds of racist evaluations about the, you know, the work ethic or the character of different indigenous nations in Canada. There's all kinds of disparaging stuff about the, you know, the emerging Métis people. The Métis in some ways come together as a nationality because at a certain point, the HBC adopted racist employment practices such that the mixed children of their employees could only reach a certain point of the occupational ladder. And especially, as you know, as you mentioned, this deepens over time. And as, you know, as the HBC comes to realize that a white settler society is going to be created in the West, and people in the HBC want to be a part of that, the company becomes more and more racist. And so one indication of that is that company employees shift from marrying, you know, First Nations women to marrying Métis women, and then eventually after 1820 or so, to marrying white women. And by the late 19th century, you have all these people with long histories in the fur trade who have to deny their entire family identity and their family history, and to try to assimilate into the white settler society that's now been created. So I think it's very, very important to recognize. And we talk about, you know, the wealth here. There's this area in Montreal called the Golden Square Mile that used to exist. And basically, what the Golden Square Mile was in 19th century Canada, where all the wealth was, all the economic power, and a good portion of the political power as well. And basically, how it started was that the men who were getting rich off of the Northwest Company around 1800 started to build mansions in what was then outside the city, what's now basically the area around McGill and the slopes of Mount Royal. And their wealth was so, you know, it's so outclassed the other merchants in Lower Canada at the time and the, you know, the late feudal landowning class in Quebec. These fur traders were buying seigneuries. They were buying up the feudal landholdings of the old French Canadian landowning class. And their wealth built McGill University, right? And their wealth built these ornate mansions all over Montreal. And so again, you see, you know, on the one hand, in Western North America, indigenous nations are being driven to undermine their own economic self-sufficiency and the ecological, you know, sort of balance on which they, you know, they had depended. And then back in Montreal and in London, a huge amount of capital is being accumulated. So I think that's, you know, that's the way that we need to think about the fur trade, as being a means by which, you know, we talked about the contribution of indigenous land to the birth of Canadian capitalism. But there's also, through the fur trade, indigenous labor makes an enormous contribution to the development of Canadian capitalism in a way that proves, you know, self-undermining for the indigenous people of the West. And I know I said there was just going to say a couple things about the fur trade, but I just think it's important to flesh those things out a little bit, because it's, you know, as in, you know, the tricentenary celebration of the HBC, it's often sort of very romanticized. If you go to the website of the HBC's, or the HBC has a website about its own history that you can poke around, and it's still basically purveying this sort of romantic narrative about itself, as if this critique that's been made against it since the 1970s by indigenous activists and by sort of more serious recent Canadian historians has never happened. So I think it's important to sort of to de-romanticize the fur trade a little bit.
So obviously this is like a massive, obviously played a massive role in the shaping of the modern colonial state of Canada. Yeah. Like this is where this comes from. But in terms of like the resistance to that trade,
yeah.
right? Like this is like in terms of the Métis who were engaged in this trade, yeah. like as a nation, they were part of this for a long time. They had the relationship with the Hudson's Bay Company. Mm-hmm. But that relationship ultimately gets dramatically altered, at least in the context of the Red River settlement, as soon as you start getting settlement in that region. So how did that process really take